Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast, this week brought to you in partnership with our sponsors, World Defence Show and Raytheon Missiles and Defence. I'm your host this week, Ben Vogel, and I'm joined by our military training editor, Trevor Nash. Hi, Trevor.
Hello, Ben.
And our air editor, Tim Martin. Hello, Tim.
Hi, morning.
Welcome back to both of you. Before we dive into today's topics, I just wanted to give our listeners a quick snapshot of the kind of stories that we're going to be looking at today. We will, of course, give you an overview of the ITSEC exhibition that's taking place in Orlando this week, and then we will look at updates on the Eurodrone and FCAS programs. And in the second part of the show, our senior naval reporter, Harry Lai, will speak to the Aircraft Carrier Industrial Base Coalition to discuss ongoing supply chain shortages that are affecting the aircraft carrier industrial base. So, Trevor, let's start with you, over to you, as it were. You are, in fact, on site in Orlando at the moment. So how is Florida?
It's good, Ben. Speaking to the various companies that are exhibiting at the event, there's a great feeling of positivity in that this is the first time they've been back at a show and able to talk to each other, because last year was virtual, of course. So there's a definite feeling of positivity. There's quite a few programs going on about to be awarded, and it's very active and very positive. That's definitely the mood of the show.
Excellent. Well, that's quite encouraging. Although your timing is just about ideal, because you managed to get out there for a trade show just before the Omicron variant raises its ugly head. I mean, in terms of attendance, you mentioned there's a good mood of positivity. Have there been a lot of international non-US organisations attending?
Yeah, there always are, Ben, because, compared to other training trade shows around the world, this is, the mother of them all. And Orlando, being the sort of epicenter for defense procurement in the United States, draws people, like a magnet. So in terms of numbers this year, yes, sure, it's down a bit. The exhibitor numbers are down probably by around 100 companies. But the fact of the matter is, you walk around the halls, I see people from Holland, Germany, France, big contingent from Brazil, wall-to-wall Americans, of course. So there still is that international presence at the show, which is great to see.
And would you say that there is a sort of single overarching theme that epitomises what's going on at ITSEC this year?
There are a couple of themes, really. And I suppose if I had to try to encapsulate them in one descriptive sentence, it would be that they are trying to do more, get more training value from new emerging technologies. So, for example, if I can give you an example there, historically, the simulator system integrators, have used proprietary engineering and technologies to develop things like image generators. This year, CAE has launched what it calls its Prodigy IG, Prodigy Image Generator, alongside Epic Games. And so the basis of that particular image generator is Epic Games Unreal Engine. Now, they say in the blurb that new image generator has the ability to support a 1,000-fold increase in the number of entities in a virtual environment. And that's obviously significant. And the cost of the thing has come down compared to proprietary. So I think that is one of the themes of the show, doing more with less.
Okay. And also, what's been happening in the industry recently has been fairly interesting in terms of mergers and acquisitions. You filed a story recently, for example, on the purchase of Bohemia Interactive Simulation by BAE Systems. And perhaps you can talk a little bit about that, Trevor. I mean, your story mentions some alarm bells are ringing, so it sounds quite a severe impact.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, Ben. I had the opportunity of speaking to Pete Morrison, the co-CEO of BSIM, a couple of days ago. And he said that the way that they're perceiving the operating environment with BAE Systems owning the company now, that BAE Systems are very much going to leave them to get on with the job in hand and follow through their business plan. They're going to keep their own name, and I think very much now it's going to be business as usual for them. One of the big issues, of course, that a lot of people said to me, that if they're owned by a big corporation like BAE, they will lose their flexibility. They'll lose their ability to react to requirements in the market. But it would appear that that fear is certainly lessened.
Okay. And your story, you mentioned that there may be a shiver of nervousness, a very evocative phrase that goes through the current and potential iSIM customer base. Because at the moment, the customers have to deal with a fairly agile company, a fairly small firm, and also an independent one. But now with BAE Systems taking over, there's a whole kind of different culture which comes to the fore.
Yeah, and I think that was the thing that Pete Morrison was keen to point out to me, that he doesn't believe there's going to be a change in culture, because he told me that the company has been for sale for a number of years. BAE Systems, as I said earlier, are going to really leave it as it is, as a single entity, without subsuming it into the corporate mass. So I think on reflection, it will be very much business as usual for that BSIM customers, which is great news, of course, because they are providing an excellent product in service throughout the world. The latest bit of BSIM news, which I can unveil here, is that the Royal Netherlands Army have just signed a contract for VBS4 licenses. So it's going incredibly well for the company.
Okay. Yeah, continuity is always important, I suppose, in this industry as any other. Also, at ITSEC, you've been very active, of course, Trevor, busy on the show floor. You report on moves by the US Air Force to potentially get rid of a large number of aircraft.
Yeah, you know, Ben, I was amazed at this. As we all know, and we've reported it extensively over the years, the US Air Force, through their Pilot Training Next program, were using lower-cost training devices at an early stage in what we Brits call ab initio, elementary training, to allow students to progress through the training pipeline at their own pace. That was all well and good. And you know, the RAF in the UK is copying that to an extent, or carrying out experimentation in that area. But I was chatting to SAIC, who were involved in Pilot Training Next early on, and they were telling me that the US Air Force now is looking at a new system whereby multi-engined aircraft, their T-1A, Jayhawk aeroplanes, are going to be removed from service. Now, they've got 178 of these in service. They're going to take them out. And so the pilot, when they finish their training, are going to go on to simulators, multi-engine simulators, and then go straight to the operational fleet and learn to fly, for instance, you know, in the air mobility world, the C-130. So they'll go straight from training environment through simulation onto the operational fleet and move on from there. And I was talking to SAIC about this, and I said, well, actually, it's not new. I remember being at a conference 20-odd years ago, a commercial airline conference, where the training captain of a major airline was actually putting a fly on the water and saying, do we really need this multi-engine training? Simulation now is so good. Why don't we train in the simulator and then put them onto the operational aircraft? And it looks as though now that the United States Air Force is taking that bull by the horns and doing it.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be an endorsement of progress in simulation technology if they're willing to take this step. I just wanted to ask you, Trevor, obviously this is a move in the US by the US Air Force. Could you foresee, are there any signs of allied air forces in other NATO countries, for instance, going down this route?
You know, there are, Ben. It's quite interesting. For instance, in the UK, as an example, historically, rotary wing pilots would do a fixed wing phase. That is now beginning to be, the fixed wing flying stage of it is now is reducing, and in some cases being taken out of the syllabus altogether. So there are moves. And of course, in Europe in general, the NATO Flying Training Europe program, NFTE, that's beginning to gather momentum. And during this phase now, they're looking at how they can undertake their training. And it's not only to save costs, it's to become more economical and keep people in the training pipeline for less time. And that's the thing. If I just might add as well, though, it's not just on the air side. That seems to be the most technical side of simulation. But even on the ground side, it's absolutely fascinating. Historically, soldiers have trained on what we call gallery ranges. So linear ranges where they fire at targets either pop up, moving from side to side, or static targets. And that's the way it's always been done. There's a company called Marathon, and they've been in the market for a long time, but Marathon are now arguing that those sort of gallery ranges, you can only do so much training. So both the use of artificial intelligence in their targets, for instance, if you get a group of Marathon targets coming towards you, if you fire, the group automatically bomb bursts in different directions, which is realistic, and it's what would happen in real life. So they're really plugging this now. The US Marine Corps have placed several contracts with them, and they're now trying to convince the US Army, which of course is a massive market, of the benefits of such targets. So that's something I'm going to be keeping my eye on over the next couple of years.
It certainly seems as though there's a change of mentality around range training that is coming to the fore, Trevor. Is that only evident or primarily evident through Marathon, or are there other industry participants who are moving in that direction?
There are a number of companies that do this. However, Marathon have been out there for, it must be nearly 15 years or so now. They have got, if you imagine you're shooting at a mobile target, that target needs to be armoured at the base where the motor is, where the wheels are. And they've certainly developed some very sophisticated software, AI-driven software, to enable the targets to basically undertake the same things that a human attacking force would do. So I would say, without wishing to upset other companies, that they're certainly leading the pack at the moment.
That's all right, Trevor. You dug yourself out of that hole very nicely. just a final question. Generally speaking, do you actually see a kind of an overall change of culture in the training sphere as a result of the new technologies, new programs, and new concepts that are that are emerging in the training area?
It's always difficult, you know, Ben. I was speaking to a very senior executive last night over a beer, and he said to me, "Oh, it's the same old, isn't it? You know, there's nothing really new. Have you seen anything new?" I'm a bit of an enthusiast for it, and it's not necessarily the technology which is new, but it's how that technology is being used, i.e. the US Air Force and the T1A, i.e. Marathon and its ground targets, i.e. CAE going to a games-based image generator. So there are no massive changes. It doesn't change overnight. But there is a culture of, as I mentioned at the beginning of our talk, that there are technologies now which are being used to change the overall process of the training pipeline, how people go through that training pipeline. So that, for me, is the exciting side of it, the more intellectual application of the technology, as opposed to, hey, we've got a great new image generator here. The image generator on its own is nothing. It's how it's used, which is the important thing.
Thank you very much, Trevor. And just a reminder to our listeners that our ITSEC microsite, our show site, remains free to view until the 15th of December. And you can access it via our homepage, www.shepherdmedia.com/news. Moving on to the air domain now. And Tim, you attended some pretty interesting briefings this week from Airbus on a couple of the programs that they're involved in, one of which is the Eurodrone program. So perhaps you can give us a flavour of what emerged from those briefings.
Yeah, will do, Ben. And maybe just to give a little bit of background to our listeners, Airbus hosts the annual trade briefing once a year. And for trade media journalists, it very much feels like an early Christmas gift, because it's always held around the end of November, early December. And they have their senior executives on board from military aircraft programs to the CEO even speaks at this. So it's really a day-long event where, all of the latest updates are handed out from Airbus on the programs that they're working on. And of course, yeah, as you mentioned, Eurodrone is one of the biggest, and is Europe's leading program when it comes to male UAVs, at least multinational program.
It's a big cross-border program, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. So it's Germany, Italy, France and Spain who are heading it at the governmental level. And then from industrially, you're talking about the real heavyweights within Europe, Airbus, Leonardo and Dassault are all involved in the design and production of the aircraft. But really, the latest update is that they are preparing to sign off on a stage two development contract. So this is effectively the green light for the go-ahead to industry to say, let's have this designed and produced and delivered to the partner nations. So it's absolutely critical. Daniela Lohwasser, who's the Eurodrone chief engineer at Airbus, was mentioning that everyone is pretty much awaiting Spain given the green light for the signature. So that is effectively the holdup. Germany, Italy and France have already signed off on it. So it's up to Spain now to pretty much put the pen to paper. And once that happens, then industry are ready to go. And as I say, can effectively execute the Eurodrone program. And then they'll move into a critical design review, she was saying, 18 months after this stage two contract has been signed. So, you know, she didn't give away or indicate why Spain are slightly reluctant, let's say, than the others to sign off on it. Not really sure what the holdup is there. And of course, she can't speak on behalf of the Spanish government, nor would you expect her to. But she did at least, you know, come forward with, very frankly, with the mention of Spain being the reason for the holdup. But the contract will be signed, she said, in the coming months. So barring any kind of unforeseen difficulties, that will go ahead okay. And so there was also mentioned, because I did ask about whether or not the Eurodrone will be armed, because, you know, it's politically...
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, of course, it's politically contentious. Previously, Germany have said that they will not arm Eurodrone, and of course, the wider debate that the German kind of continues to have on whether or not it will arm its Air Force's drones, you know, continues. But having said that, to come back to Eurodrone specifically, she did mention that the development program will not include the development of weapons or weapons integration, but it will allow for provisions of weapons. So it's slightly technical now, but to split those two up, it means that the design of the aircraft would have payloads and weapons releases set up within the design. And so if customers in the future wish for weapons to be added, then of course they could have them. And then, you know, potentially for Germany specifically, I think it would just be a matter then of not having those weapons releases and the payloads themselves fitted to the aircraft. So it's an interesting one because it very clearly shows that there will be different configurations and you know, different uses for the Eurodrone when it eventually manages to get into production.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting updates on Eurodrone. But also, Tim, you heard some rather intriguing potential sort of developments in terms of FCAS.
Yeah, that's right. I thought this was very, very interesting. Now, originally, what I'm going to mention was from a report from Reuters, so give kind of due credit to the first publication to take the story forward. Because on the 23rd of November, just to go back a little bit, General Luca Goretti, who's the chief of staff of the Italian Air Force, told the Defence Committee in Italy that investing huge financial resources in two separate European sixth-generation fighter programmes, those being FCAS and Tempest, would be, to use his words, unthinkable and pretty much unsustainable in terms of financial resources. You know, he's effectively saying that when it comes to financial affairs, there's just no way that these two programs will ever reach out to production through to the 2040s. So, I mean, I think that's really interesting, because if you ask defence analysts, they would say, well, we've kind of been saying that for some time. You know, the numbers don't really add up, and you very rarely hear someone so senior talk like this. And you know, you would have to imagine that he has some insight on the numbers, and you know, he's not just plucking this type of idea from thin air, because it's a really frank admission. And so, what was really then interesting when I turned it over or asked for the thoughts of the Airbus CEO Michael Schulhorn, he said that Gretti's statement was interesting, and he also agreed that, or he diplomatically said, conventional wisdom would say in the end it will be very difficult for two programs in Europe to survive. You know, so you know, playing his cards slightly closer to his chest,
as you'd expect. And, yeah,
exactly, for good reason. But I think beyond that, what was really interesting in terms of what Schulhorn was saying was that because BAE and Airbus are in kind of almost constant communication, or at least meet frequently, you know, virtually or in a room to talk on Eurofighter, because both are partners, as we know, they've never once raised industrial implications of FCAS and Tempest merging. And I think that's really interesting and fascinating, because you would imagine, you know, if it was a reality for industry, that there would need to be some type of contingency plan if there was going to be a merger, that perhaps those types of discussions would be going on behind the scenes. But my interpretation would be, because FCAS and Tempest, the planning of both are so far advanced, particularly when it comes to demonstrators, planning on what a next generation fighter is going to look like. Certainly in FCAS's case, there's discussions between Airbus and Dassault ongoing about a next generation fighter. I mean specifically an aircraft or platform, not FCAS as a whole. That specific conversation is being continued to be had. And then with Tempest as well, you know, we heard at DSAI that 2XL are continuing with design and build work on a modified 757 known as Excalibur. And so that's going to be test out sensors and combat air technologies. You know, and the aircraft itself is a test bed for Tempest, and that's going to, well, scheduled to fly in 2023. So I would just say that to give a kind of good firm sense of the fact that, you know, these plans, while they once were just on paper, you know, and they were, you know, maybe not thought of as particularly ambitious until we got near to the time. Well, actually, on both sides, FCAS and Tempest, you know, there's huge resources that have been put forward for both, and I mean that from industry and from government. So, you know, if not that it is hugely far-fetched to suggest that the two might eventually merge, it's just, it still feels very difficult to comprehend how, in terms of the you know, the technicalities of all this, how it would go forward. But clearly, in the end, it's ultimately a political decision. So, you know, you would imagine that the partner nations will at some stage have to come together and sign off on all of this. And yeah, I think a lot of industry executives will then be scratching their heads and wondering what they've been doing for the last 4 or 5 years. But
it sounds like a head scratcher, and certainly a headache as well.
Definitely. I think that's probably the case. But I think what'll be interesting now is, you know, now that, so to speak, the genie is out of the bottle, or, you know, a senior figure has felt comfortable with coming forward and you know, and predicting that two will become one, so to speak, then will this lead to, you know, others in Tempest, for example, you know, suggesting the same things? Will we hear more of it? Or, you know, was it more of a kind of off-the-cuff remark to a committee? Or will we kind of continue to hear news of this? And but as I say, I think actually the big telling point will be if there's a political announcement. All well and good listening to our force chief, but 100% this will have to be a political decision. At least that would be my feeling on it.
Indeed. And I suppose, Tim, the window of opportunity for a merger, given the practical difficulties that you mentioned, the window of opportunity for a merger between these two very complex programs, it gets narrower and narrower all the time. In other words, there comes a time, there will be a time, when FCAS and Tempest have each advanced to such an extent that, in a sense, the die has been cast and there's no turning back. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely, Ben. I think that's a very interesting point. I mean, you can't build a program like this and, you know, move it through to a very mature stage, and then, you know, and then pretty much close up shop and move on to something else. Or, and I think particularly when it comes to the manufacturing, this all gets very difficult, because when you look at what's happening between particularly Airbus and Dassault, that in terms of what Airbus would ideally want, they pretty much want three demonstrators, one based in France, one in Germany, and one in Spain. And the demonstrators themselves would include parts of legacy Eurofighter and Typhoon technologies. And it's very hard to see, you know, if you evolve that or you move that logic on a bit, how then you would put BAE into the mix there and say, okay, well, do we have a fourth demonstrator with, because, you know, Tempest, you know, there's been lots of money put into that. You can't just say, you know, include BAE, but say, well, we don't really want to include a new demonstrator. And also, this is not to say that what Airbus wants in terms of their preference for three demonstrators is going to happen. They've mentioned that's their preference, but, you know, as actually Schulhorn kind of suggested, that Airbus and Dassault have kind of locked horns here on, as he put it, exchanges around the next generation aircraft. So there's nothing smooth really happening on that front. So, you know, add BAE into that mix, and it doesn't really look like there's an easy win for all four, if it ever was to come to that. So certainly on the industrial side, I don't know. I would be very dubious as to how this all happens overnight, let's say, or, you know, if there was a political decision to say, okay, you know, the numbers really don't add up here. We're very much struggling, so let's change course. You know, and then do you then think, well, would one aircraft manufacturer be entirely excluded? You know, would that mean there's kind of legal recourse and everything? You know,
and political as well, as you said earlier on.
No. Now, look, I'm kind of maybe risking speculation with all of that. You know, none of this might happen, and, you know, the money might be there in the end for both. But I don't know. I really just struggle with how, certainly from a practical point of view and an industrial point of view, how you could include all of the manufacturers without one or other not being up in arms over, you know, work share arrangements or the returns that they might have been promised through FCAS compared to what the returns might be from a single program, Tempest, compared to what might have been or what will be forecast if there's only one program. And yeah, and then on a lighter note, then what would we call this single program? You amalgamate FCAS and Tempest somehow. I don't know. But anyway, I think that was probably one of the bigger stories to come out of the Airbus a trade briefing.
Okay.
And but interesting to see where we are kind of 12 months on then, and we'll be able to ask more questions around this.
Well, I think you're going to keep an eye on this one, Tim, for sure. Thank you very much for updating listeners on that Airbus briefing.
Anytime.
And thank you also for Trevor on his input. For our listeners, if you want to find out more about our weekly defence coverage, previous episodes of the podcast, video content and more, please visit our website, shepherdmedia.com/news. That's all from me, Tim and Trevor today. We will now go into a short break, and then we're back with Harry Lai in conversation with ACIBC.
When it comes to missile defense, timing is everything. Radiant Technologies' early warning radar provides a 5,000-kilometer range that simultaneously enables space surveillance and the ability to detect and track ballistic missile threats as quickly as possible, while distinguishing between actual attacks and objects that pose no threat. Modernized for today, ready for tomorrow, the early warning radar from Raytheon Technologies delivers persistent, advanced surveillance and assurance at all times. Learn more at rtx.com/EWR.
Welcome back to the podcast. Joining me now to talk about supply chains and specifically the US aircraft carrier industrial base is Rick Giannini, president and CEO of the Milwaukee Valve Company, and serves as chairman of the Aircraft Carrier Industrial Base Coalition. Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Eric. My pleasure to be here.
So thank you for taking the time to speak to us today. So just obviously everyone's well aware since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic of the effects on supply chain shortages that are still with us today. So how are supply chain shortages affecting the industrial base that builds aircraft carriers?
Sure. So, you know, as the pressures on the global supply chain continue to disrupt our economy here in America, there's a great deal of conversation around the causes, impacts, and solutions. The pressures are impacting our industry because the parts and components that are used that used to take weeks to get here are now taking months. And these longer lead times are impacting delivery in the private and public sectors. Manufacturing companies like Milwaukee Valve are a critical part of that supply chain. And we're working with the shipyards to communicate how these pressures, you know, can and will and are impacting orders. You know, the national security industrial base that we're part of are facing these headwinds, but they're not the only problems we're facing. They actually run a bit deeper. What we're really finding is that the real issue is our domestic side of the business, and finding and keeping qualified, skilled labor is our biggest challenge and threat today, which is the case for our sub-tiers as well.
And so for the kinds of companies that kind of you represent and as part of the Aircraft Carrier Coalition, there's obviously that duopoly of military work and commercial work. So how important is the solid commercial pipeline to ensuring you can deliver for the military customer?
So the ACIBC has over 2,000 companies in 46 states, so, and we're doing $8.8 billion worth of work. So we're a big group, and you know, we are definitely, each business is different. Some are highly dependent on the Navy or defense business to the tune of 100%. Some are, you know, 20% of the defense versus 80% of the commercial side. And what we're seeing is that there's components that are being impacted, particularly when it comes to electronics that are going in the products that we supply to the Navy that are impacted by this global issue we're facing right now.
So they kind of mentioned there the kind of the semiconductors and the chip shortages. Obviously, that's an issue affecting every sector from kind of the military to the production of cars, consumer electronics. With so much demand, do you think there's an easy solution for that?
there's generally never an easy solution, I would say. But what we're seeing is that it's progressively getting a little bit better. We're finding that the lead time itself, which was, you know, in the 30-day time to get products over here, as high as 75 or 80. We're seeing containers make it back here in 35 days. And we're seeing production levels of goods that were really under attack, like the chips, start to come back. So I think it's improving. And, you know, over the course of the next several months to a year, I think this will be in the rear window.
And so in terms of actually building new carriers, obviously, like you mentioned, how some of these items have long lead times, and with the way the ships being so complex, the way they're built, do you see these shortages actually affecting the production rates?
To some extent, they will affect production, but I think it's a relatively small percentage of the products. The bulk of the products that our industrial supply base are providing to these carriers are really products that are domestic. Every product in Milwaukee Valve's portfolio is made here in the United States. We actually have our own foundry. We port products. Our competitors are buying castings from domestic sources. There's a handful of items that we can't get in America, even our own products, but none of them are coming out of China, which is where this whole global supply chain issue is actually at.
And so you mentioned there the domestic products that you're supplying to the prime contractors building the aircraft carriers. In terms of the port backlogs that we see in the US at the moment, is that compounding the problems you're facing, or is it not too big of an issue?
Yes, the port backlogs are compounding the problem. But again, it's not the real issue that we're facing. You know, like many of the 2,000 companies across the nation that make up this aircraft industrial base, you know, Milwaukee Valve is one that is rooted here in the United States. And as a result, we never shut down through the global pandemic. The men and women of the industrial base continue to show up every day and deliver for the U.S. government, the taxpayer, and the warfighter. And what's really helped us as the supply base is that a few years ago, the Navy signed a two-ship buy for CVN 80 and 81 Ford-class carriers. This contract and the stability and predictability it gave to the industry has become even more important and helpful during this pandemic. I think it's really aided us because that contract we have for those 80 and 81 is one in the Milwaukee Valve's case, and I know a lot of other suppliers. We're buying all the product ahead of time for an 8-year build cycle. So I'm bringing that material in, and the real issue for me is getting it back out the door. I have the material, I need the labor. And that's where my issues are, is on the labor side.
And so in terms of the labor shortages that kind of major shipyards are facing, and the smaller SMEs that are also working into these projects, what kind of are some of the key issues facing those areas at the moment?
You know, the worker shortage, as you say, it's not just a national defense side of things. It's the entire economy. The COVID pandemic, where 1.4 million manufacturing jobs were erased, according to a report by Deloitte and the Manufacturing Institute, 820,000 jobs have been added back by the end of 20, but 500,000 positions have not been hired back. What we're seeing are levels of employment below our historical requirements in the 10% plus range right now. And it's, I think, when I talk to the folks in the ACIBC and even on my commercial side of the world, we're all facing these challenges. And the industrial base looks to the future. It's also being confronted with regulation challenges that we're concerned about.
And so just if you could elaborate a little bit on the kind of regulatory challenges you're facing. I imagine that's kind of compounded by the vaccine mandates for kind of the national security jobs.
That's precisely it. That in itself is a very difficult scenario, which would in depending on which mandate. One of them's held up in the courts right now, which would be OSHA mandate, and it would have a very difficult impact on a businesses that are already having trouble finding and keeping qualified employees.
And just to go back to the domestic production side, are you seeing, obviously you mentioned how you kind of have foundries and products for the carriers tend to be built domestically in the US because of national security reasons. Are you having any issues actually getting the raw materials, or is that kind of process as smooth as it's always been?
I would say that has been slowed down. Our lead times for our raw materials, the good news is when we cast something, we buy ingot. That really has never slowed down. But we rely on lots of components also. And those components are coming from manufacturers that are having similar issues that we are. They can't get the labor, and the workload is high. They're missing time from employees because of COVID absences. So it's slowed the whole process down.
Obviously, this is a particularly challenging issue. And like you say, it's compounded by lots of different factors. But are there any immediate solutions that at the ACIBC that you think could be put into place that would help alleviate some of these pressures?
Good question. You know, from a solution standpoint, I think we're looking for workforce development improvements. So there's pipelines of skilled workers. So efforts are underway through public and private partnerships in certain U.S. regions throughout workforce pipeline projects, enabling employers to recapitalize their workforce through recruiting, hiring, training. One example is the Pennsylvania Pipeline Program. They are identifying employers with a hiring demand, training, coaching, and supporting them to establish a pipeline that'll create reliable talent acquisition and ultimately retention. It's a positive, but it takes time. There's another training program out there. It's called ATDM, which is short for Accelerated Training in Defense Manufacturing. It's a prototype training platform. And what it does, it rapidly trains skilled workers in trades like CNC machining, welding, quality. It's actually a four-month program, 16 weeks, and it gives people the skills that would normally come from a technical college taking 1.5 to 2 years. It's a pilot program, so there's no more than about 60 folks enrolled in it at any one time. So the hope is that programs like this can be started in a greater number in geographical locations around the U.S. and be large enough in scale to provide qualified workers to the entire industry. That's the hope. It's going to take some time, though.
And in terms of the long-term picture, obviously, eventually the world will recover and kind of go back to some semblance of normal. But looking past that, are there any lessons learned for kind of the companies that feed into the defense supply chain that you think will be taken forward?
I do think so. I think that the definite two-ship buy and programs that are multi-ship procurements have really shown that the Navy can fund its industrial base with long-term contracts that give them stability and predictability over long periods of time, allowing us, in some cases like mine and others, where we're buying those materials ahead of time, and now we're staging them through our facilities. It's dramatically reduced the potential for disruptions. The labor piece, while it is disruptive at this point, I do think in time it will work itself out. It's much more difficult when you don't have the raw materials, like it's happening with the global pandemic and crisis coming out of China.
And so just on a kind of final note, in terms of actual support from the Navy and government, obviously on a headline level, the Navy can advance procurement to prime contractors and support can be made quite easily to these big primes. Do you think there's enough support being made directly to kind of SMEs and smaller companies?
I think we need to continue to do what we've done. When we survey, the ACIBC surveys our members, and 6 out of 10 said that those Navy contracts that we got saved jobs. 9 out of 10 said multi-year contracts are important to the health and future of their businesses. So I think those are critical, helping us through this potential vaccine mandate will dramatically help us in this short run period. And I think those are the bottom line issues that, you know, predictability, stability, and funding.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for your time and thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
For over 40 years, Shepherd has led the defense and aerospace sector with magazines, equipment handbooks, and cutting-edge news stories. Shepherd now champions the best business information and marketing solutions across digital, so your business can have the decisive edge in everything you do. Make your team the competitive advantage. Partner with Shepherd today. Get in touch with one of our customer experts to discuss your needs at shepherdmedia.com.
This episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast was brought to you in partnership with our sponsors, World Defence Show and Raytheon Missiles and Defence. As always, a big thanks to everyone who took the time to be with us today. And for our listeners, if you enjoyed the show, make sure you like and subscribe or leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.